It's time for the 4th Annual Progressive Festival. This year's event focuses on community issues as well as the media and international events. It will take place Sunday, September 2nd, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Walnut Park in downtown Petaluma. It's a Labor Day celebration of the people who do the work. Featured speakers include Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange, Peter Phillips of Project Censored, and yours truly, Andrea Lewis, will be emceeing. Other guests include Utah Phillips, Faith Petrick, and the Love Choir with music to lift your spirits, and progressive organizations will be there presenting information about their work. The 4th Annual Progressive Festival, Sunday, September 2nd in Petaluma. For more information, call 707-763-8134.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I declare open the World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance.
The United Nations opens its historic World Conference Against Racism as thousands take to the streets of Durban, South Africa, demanding action from world governments. A Dutch court rejects the Milosevic appeal to have the war crimes tribunal declared illegal, and the home of Palestinian leader Abu Leila is partially destroyed in Ramallah. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Dutch court in The Hague has rejected an appeal brought by lawyers supporting former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. The appeal asks that Holland's court declare the International War Crimes Tribunal illegal and order Milosevic return to Yugoslavia. From The Hague, Democracy Now!'s Jeremy Scahill reports.
The ruling that was brought down from the Dutch court today defended the International War Crimes Tribunal, saying that, in fact, it was established lawfully and that it constituted an independent and impartial judicial body. Milosevic's attorneys, the attorneys that had been supporting him, attempting to get the case thrown out via the Dutch court and asked that the former Yugoslav president be returned to Yugoslavia. Milosevic's lawyers say that they intend to appeal that ruling. Meanwhile, they say that Milosevic is also going to continue with his political defense and his rejection of the court's jurisdiction over him, saying that even though he's potentially going to be charged for genocide for the war in Bosnia and Croatia, that he's going to continue on with this political defense. Now, there was another development yesterday. Yugoslav lawyers that are currently advising Milosevic released a 35-plus page document that was written by Slobodan Milosevic. He had been prevented from reading it yesterday in court, so he submitted it, and then their lawyers turned it to the journalist, and I got it late last night. And essentially the statement is Milosevic blasting the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, charging that it is a political tool of NATO and the United States more particularly. He criticizes as well the establishment of these ad hoc tribunals, such as is the case in Rwanda as well as here at The Hague. He says that this is a ruse aimed at preventing the establishment of a true international criminal court, as Milosevic says that a majority of the countries in the world would like to see. One other development is that the court has now forced Slobodan Milosevic to take on what's called an amicus curiae, which is a friend of the court, to participate in his defense. This is against protections of Slobodan Milosevic. He does not want any lawyers working with him at this time, certainly not ones pointed by the Hague Tribunal. Amy?
Thank you very much, Jeremy. Last question is, does it resume on Monday?
No. What's going to happen now is that there's going to be early in October, Carla Del Ponte, the chief war crimes prosecutor, has said that she's going to issue these new indictments against Slobodan Milosevic for the war in Bosnia and Croatia. And she says that she intends to include a genocide charge in that. Milosevic's next appearance in court will be on October 29th. It will be another hearing of this nature, supposed to be routine. But if Slobodan Milosevic's last two appearances are any indication, it will be anything but routine. And Slobodan Milosevic will continue to defy the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia.
Democracy Now!'s Jeremy Scahill reporting to us from The Hague. And now we turn to the West Bank. Last night, the home of Abu Layla, head of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine in Ramallah, was bombed and partially destroyed. He and his family fled the area 15 minutes before the attack. 2 days ago on Democracy Now!, we spoke to Abu Layla and addressed the question of his safety. Are you afraid of assassination? Are you there? Yeah.
I think that an attempt of assassination is possible. There is a long list of political and national leaders that are okayed and approved by the Israeli government, and it's not completely impossible that my name could be on that list, but I should say that this does not affect in any way neither my activity nor my political decisions or political affiliations.
Abu Layla speaking just 2 days ago on Democracy Now! He is head of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine in Ramallah. His home was bombed and partially destroyed just hours ago. He and his family fled the area 15 minutes before the attack. We now go to Free Speech Radio News reporter Raphael Kraft, who is in Ramallah. Can you describe what's happening there, Raphael?
First of all, Abu Layla had been informed by the Palestinian security members that his life was in danger. Palestinian security services had information that Abu Layla was on the hit list. The DFLP has revendicated the spectacular action that occurred last Saturday night in the Gush Katif settlement block by a commando of its armed branch, killing three Israelis. But the origin of the explosion that occurred last night is still unknown, Palestinian security officers were saying. And in the meantime, Israeli officials say they do not know anything about what happened last night. In the meantime, Abu Ali Mustafa, who is another political figure in the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, has been assassinated last Monday. It has raised a big anger in the Palestinian street. It has also raised the actions held by the Palestinian resistance in the last few days. So this bomb blast that occurred last night is very, how would I say, Israeli officials are often state, many explosions occur, especially in the Gaza Strip. Many explosions occur in some buildings, and the Israeli officials are saying that these are accidents that occur during Hamas or Islamic Jihad bomb cells who are preparing bombs. But there are many doubts about that. And in the last few months, in particular, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, a building close to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, who is doing a great job to denounce the Israeli violation of human rights, has had a big explosion close to its building. And Raji Surani, the head of this Palestinian human rights organization, was very doubtful about the fact that there was a Hamas or an Islamic Jihad cell close to its building. So Palestinians believe that this explosion last night was effectively made by Israelis.
Raphael Kraft, Free Speech Radio News reporter in Ramallah in the West Bank. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we go live to South Africa.
I'm living so hard, baby, that my hair's gray. We got to make a change. It's a brand new day.
A new world order, a brand new day.
It's a new
a
day. Operation in flux, and it's on the way. We just marched a million plus the other day. Look, look, we all witnessed the sweat rolling down Miss Liberty's head.
She knows the sleeping giant is no longer sleeping dead. Oh, what a fulfillment of prophecy. Let us teach the children freedom's never been free. It's okay to cry, go ahead and cry. Cause tears is wet, but hope and faith be kept. It's a new day.
World order, a brand new day.
It's a new day.
The late Curtis Mayfield, New World Order, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. More than 6,000 delegates from 130 countries are gathered in Durban, South Africa today as the United Nations opens its historic World Conference Against Racism. People at the eight-day conference hope to produce a global plan of action to combat racism. South African President Thabo Mbeki, in his opening remarks, painted a grim picture of a world divided between poor people of color and rich whites. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, in charge of the proceedings, says much of the world is still deeply angered at Europe and the United States' lack of recognition of the impact of slavery and the exploitation of colonialism. The United States and European countries have harshly criticized language in the conference agenda referring to the impact of slavery and colonialism and calling for reparations. The U.S., Canada, and Israel have limited their representation to mid-level delegations in response to what they say is offensive language towards Israel in the conference's draft declaration, although any equation between Zionism and racism has been dropped. India and China have also been working to keep the issues of India's Dalit, or untouchable class, and repression in Tibet off the agenda. Criticism of Israel, the discussion of reparations for slavery, and the U.S. refusal to send a high-level delegation have dominated media coverage in this country. But government leaders, activists, and non-governmental organizations, representatives from around the world, insist they'll press these issues, as well as the plight of indigenous people, migrant workers, Europe's Roma people, and environmental racism. Non-governmental organizations have been meeting in Durban all this week to press their national delegations and increase the visibility of grassroots agendas against racism, holding an international youth summit, People's Global Action Gathering, and an international landless people's assembly. As we broadcast, thousands of demonstrators led by COSATU, the South African trade union movement, are marching towards the conference venue, saying the UN agenda on racism does not go far enough. Well, today and all next week, Democracy Now! Will be breaking the sound barrier and bringing you extended coverage of the UN World Conference Against Racism live from Durban, South Africa. We'll go to the conference halls, to the streets. We'll hear the voices of grassroots activists from around the world working to eradicate racism and discrimination. But today we start in the conference hall with UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, his opening address at the opening session of the UN World Conference Against Racism.
I declare open the World Conference Against Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. I would now want to deliver a brief statement. Dear friends, every one of us must feel the symbolism of this moment. The conjunction of theme, of time, and of place. For decades, the name of this country was synonymous with racism in its vilest form. But today, Mr. President, you and your fellow citizens have transformed its meaning from a byword of injustice and oppression into a beacon of enlightenment and hope, not only for a troubled continent, but for the entire world. Where else, my friends, could we hold this conference? Who could teach us how to overcome racism, discrimination, and intolerance, if not the people of this country? We salute your lead. We salute your leadership, Mr. President. We salute the heroic movement that you represent. We salute Madiba, whose absence today we all regret, but whose presence in a more profound sense, we all feel. We salute the memory of all who struggle for justice and freedom in this country, from Mohandas Gandhi to Oliver Tambo, from Steve Biko to Ruth Fest, and of course, Governor Mbeki, for whom we are all in mourning today. And we also recognize and must mention the courage of F.W. de Klerk, who faced up to the inevitable and persuaded his own people to accept it. But indeed, my friends, we are here to learn, not to celebrate. We are here to share experiences, perspectives, and assessments of how far we have come and how much further we must go if racism is to be defeated. One thing we can celebrate is the fact that racism is now universally condemned. Few people in the world today openly deny that human beings are born with equal rights. But far too many people are still victimized because they belong to a particular group, whether national, ethnic, religious, defined by gender or by descent. Often, this discrimination veils itself behind spurious pretexts. People are denied jobs ostensibly because they lack educational qualifications, or they are refused housing because there is high crime rate in their community. Yet these very facts, even when true, are often the result of discrimination. Injustice traps people in poverty. Poverty becomes a pretext for injustice, and so new wrongs are piled on the old. In many places, people are maltreated and denied protection on the grounds that they are not citizens but unwanted immigrants. Yet often they have come to a new country to do work that is badly needed, or are present not by choice but as refugees from persecution in their own country. Such people have special need for protection, and they are entitled to it. In other cases, indigenous peoples and national minorities are oppressed because their culture and self-expression are seen as threats to national unity. And when they protest, this is taken as proof of their guilt. In extreme cases, which alas are all too common, people belonging to such groups are forced from their homes or even massacred because it is claimed that their very presence threatens another people's security. Sometimes these problems are in part the legacy of terrible wrongs in the past, such as the exploitation and extermination of indigenous peoples by colonial powers, or the treatment of millions of human beings as mere merchandise to be transported and disposed of by other human beings for commercial gain. The further those events recede into the past, the harder it becomes to trace lines of accountability. Yet the effects remain. The pain and anger are still felt. The dead, through their descendants, cry out for justice. Tracing a connection with past crimes may not always be the most constructive way to redress present inequalities in material terms. But man does not live by bread alone. The sense of continuity with the past is an integral part of each man's or each woman's identity.
You're listening to Kofi Annan, UN Secretary General, addressing the historic UN World Conference Against Racism. You are listening to Democracy Now! We go to break, and we come back. We will continue with the speech, and then we'll go outside the conference center where thousands are marching in the streets saying the conference doesn't go far enough. Stay with us.
Someday you wish upon a star. Wake up.
This is Democracy Now! Coming to you at 94.1 FM KPFA or KPFB at 89.3 in Berkeley or KFCF Fresno at 88.1. Coming up today on Living Room, today at noon, the fate of Social Security under George W. Join Chris Welch and her guests today at noon on KPFA 94.1 FM.
Dream that you did too. Oh why can't I? Well, I see trees of green and red roses too. I'll watch them bloom for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the sound barriers today and exception to the rulers. Today and all next week, Democracy Now! Will be breaking the sound barrier and bringing you extended coverage of the UN World Conference Against Racism as we go from the conference halls to the streets and hear the voices of grassroots activists from around the world working to eradicate racism and discrimination. Right now, though, the opening address of the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. We continue.
Some historical wrongs are traceable to individuals who are still alive or corporations that are still in business. They must expect to be held to account. The society they have wronged may forgive them as part of the process of reconciliation, but they cannot demand forgiveness as of right. Far more difficult are the cases where individual profit and loss have been obscured by a myriad of other more recent transactions. Yet, there is still continuity between the societies and states of today and those that committed the original crimes. Each of us has an obligation to consider where he or she belongs in this complex historical chain. It is always easier to think of the wrongs one's own society has suffered. It is less comfortable to think in what ways our own good fortune might relate to the sufferings of others in the past or present. But if we are sincere in our desire to overcome the conflicts of the past, all of us should make that mental effort. A special responsibility falls on political leaders who have accepted the task of representing a whole society. They are accountable to their fellow citizens, but also, in a sense, accountable for them and for the actions of their predecessors. We have seen in recent decades some striking examples of national leaders assuming this responsibility, acknowledging past wrongs, and asking pardon from or offering an apology to the victims and their heirs. Such gestures cannot right the wrongs of the past. They can sometimes help to free the present and the future from the shackles of the past. But in any case, Mr. President, past wrongs must not distract us from present evils. Our aim must be to banish from this new century the hatred and prejudice that have disfigured previous centuries. The struggle to do that is at the very heart of our work at the United Nations. This year especially, at such events as the Conference on the Least Developed Countries, the special session on HIV/AIDS, or next month's special session on children, we have often found racism and discrimination among the biggest obstacles to overcome. And in our peacekeeping and peacebuilding work, we often find ourselves wrestling again and again with the effects of xenophobia and intolerance. Only if we tackle these evils at source can we hope to prevent conflicts before they break out. And that means taking firm action to root them out in every society, for alas, no society is immune. Last year, the leaders of our member states resolved in their Millennium Declaration to take measures to ensure respect for and protection of the human rights of migrants, migrant workers, and their families, to eliminate the increasing acts of racism and xenophobia in many societies, and to promote greater harmony and tolerance in all societies. With those words, Mr. President, they gave this conference its true agenda. We must not leave the city without agreeing on practical measures which all states should take to fulfill that pledge. It must be reflected in our budgets and development plans, in our laws and institutions, and above all, in our school curricula. Let us remember that no one is born racist. Children learn racism as they grow up, from the society around them, and too often the stereotypes are reinforced deliberately or inadvertently by the mass media. We must not sacrifice freedom of the press, but we must actively refute pseudoscientific arguments and oppose negative images with positive ones, teaching our children and our fellow citizens not to fear diversity, but to cherish it. Friends, this conference has been especially difficult to prepare because the issues are not ones where consensus is easily found. Yes, we can all agree to condemn racism, but that very fact makes the accusation of racism against any particular individual or group particularly hurtful. It is hurtful to one's pride because few of us see ourselves as racists. And it arouses fear because once a group is accused of racism, it becomes a potential target for retaliation, perhaps for persecution in its turn. Nowhere is that truer today than in the Middle East. The Jewish people have been victims of anti-Semitism in many parts of the world. And in Europe, they were the target of the Holocaust, the ultimate abomination. This fact must never be forgotten or diminished. It is understandable, therefore, that many Jews deeply resent any accusation of racism directed against the State of Israel, and all the more so when it coincides with indiscriminate and totally unacceptable attacks on innocent civilians. Yet we cannot expect Palestinians to accept this as the reason why the wrongs done to them, displacement, occupation, blockade, and now extrajudicial killings, should be ignored, whatever label one uses to describe them. But my dear friends, Mutual accusations are not the purpose of this conference. Our main objective must be to improve the lot of the victims. Let us admit that all countries have issues of racism and discrimination to address. Rather than pick on any one country or region, let us aim to leave here with a commitment from every country to draw up and implement its own national plan to combat racism in accordance with general principles that we will have agreed. For weeks and months, our representatives have labored to reach agreement on those principles. And they have made great progress. Large parts of the Declaration of Program of Action have been agreed, including texts on such difficult issues as indigenous peoples, migrants, refugees, and people of African descent. Friends, this conference is a test of our international community, of its will to unite on a topic of central importance in people's lives. Let us not fail this test. The build-up to this conference has prompted an extraordinary mobilization of society in many different countries. It has raised expectations which we must not disappoint. If we leave here without agreement, we shall give comfort to the worst elements in every society. But if, after all the difficulties, we can leave with a call to action supported by all, we shall send a signal of hope to brave people struggling against racism all over the world. Let us rise above our disagreements. The wrangling has gone on for too long. Let us echo the slogan that resounded throughout this country during the elections of 1994, at the end of the long struggle against apartheid. Sekunjalo, the time has come. Thank you very much.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan addressing the opening session of the United Nations World Conference Against Racism. And you are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we stay in South Africa right now, in Durban, outside the conference hall where thousands of demonstrators led by COSATU, the South African trade union movement, are marching towards the conference venue, saying the UN agenda on racism does not go far enough. We're joined on the telephone right now by Hassan Lorgat, who is National Media Officer and lead organizer of SATU, the South African Democratic Teachers Union, one of the main organizers of today's rally. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Hassan Lorgat.
Thank you very much.
Can you explain why people are marching outside the World Conference?
Well, today is one part of a march, because yesterday the Federation of Workers, COSATU, led a march specifically against privatization of state-owned enterprises, which we believe is part of the agenda that is being pushed by the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, and the IMF. And really, it serves multinationals and corporate interests, largely in North America and Europe. But today, we joined in with a whole host of other groups, such as Landless People, the Anti-Privatization Forum, various groups in support of Palestine and others. Essentially, what they're arguing about is for greater inclusion, and I think they're questioning fundamentally whether the UN system can listen to the voices of southern countries, the countries of the south, but also to voices within those countries in the north who are marginalized.
The people that were marching outside over the last days, the South African government has been beseeching, I guess you could say, the trade unions not to go on strike.
Yeah. Well, the strike, it's quite interesting. I wonder if your listeners are aware that the major trade union body here called COSTRA, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, is 2 million strong, and it is in alliance with the ANC, the party in government, but not as government, but as when they were in opposition. There was an alliance that was built in struggle against racism, and that alliance constituted the motive force of our struggle to de-racialize our society. And it includes the communist parties, the civic associations called SANCO, and the unions. But what has happened since 1994, and I think that the speech of Kofi Annan is rich in symbolism when he talks about the end of formal apartheid. What has happened during those crazy periods when all of us were excited about the miracle, as they put it, because many Western journalists in particular thought there would be violence. So during that period, the years after that, there was a honeymoon period with the elegance and the, presidential leadership, kingly leadership of Mandela. There seemed to have been in some way a cement that we need to make the necessary compromises because it is necessary to build a non-racial democracy. But 7 years down the line, what the union movement and civil society organizations are finding that the pace of socio-economic transformation has been rather slow. Over 200,000 people in the public sector alone have lost jobs through state-induced restructuring, which is essentially code for privatization of essential services. In fact, we fear today when water, electricity, and telecommunications is privatized that basic services will not reach largely black people. And there's a discussion around in our movement that will have implications, or as such, reinforcing racism. So these issues, they are symbolic outside, but they do touch a nerve. And I think that the African National Congress-led government were very sensitive that these should not harm a high moment, which indeed it is in the country.
Hassan Largat, I want to thank you very much for being with us. After our break, we're going to go to a group of young people who have come from around the world to Durban, South Africa, to talk about issues of racism and injustice. Hassan Largat, National Media Officer and lead organizer of SATU, the South African Democratic Teachers Union, main organizer of the rallies outside the UN conference, third largest union in South Africa, an affiliate of COSATU, the coalition of trade union movements. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we return, young people broadcasting live from Durban, South Africa. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio as we continue to break the sound barrier in Durban, South Africa. At the first International Youth Summit, over 500 young people from Nairobi to New York, representing more than 40 countries, gathered to build a network of international youth resistance and create a manifesto of demands for action from the official delegates at the UN World Conference Against Racism. The youth gathered in Durban to discuss issues of discrimination and oppression of young people. And we're joined right now in studios in Durban, South Africa, by a group of young people, including Annie Vellengren and Desiree Bob, are both from Durban, representing Global Kids. Aisha Hassan is a 17-year-old entering college, representing Nigeria, from Jazz 38, International Center of Hearts for Humanity. Daniela McConnell is a 13-year-old going into eighth grade from Chicago, representing the Women's International Leadership Development for Human Rights. And we're also joined by Chenentu Iono, who is an indigenous Maori from the collective Pushing for Indigenous Rights in New Zealand. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Desiree Bob, you've come a long way to Durban from Global Kids. Can you talk about what's happened over the last week?
Over the last week, I was mostly in the youth summit. We're discussing the youth decoration, and it's been very, very stressful, I can say, because we have a lot of issues that we have to deal with. And most of the issues, the main issues about the translation to Spanish, English, and French, and that is very, very tough. Well, from my point of view, is we, the youths, are not really, really represented, because this is a UN conference, a world conference, and the youths, we don't have translators from the UN to translate into French or Spanish. The youth document, we don't have them translated also into French and Spanish. And the French people, the Spanish people have felt left out, and that's very sad. Other people have felt left out because they spend so many time working on the document, and what they express haven't been put in the document. And it started to see people come from so far over the world, and their voices haven't been really heard.
Desiree is a citizen of St. Vincent, entering his senior year in high school. Aisha Hassan from Nigeria, can you talk about your experience in this week leading up to the World Conference Against Racism and the message you bring from Nigeria? Hi, it's great to have you with us. And maybe the engineer could turn down the microphones of everyone but you, Aisha, so we can really hear your voice well.
From Nigeria, well, I'm here to witness all the conferences and get report back home to the people, and give them full report of what has been happening at the conferences and what has been done and what needs to be done. Well, at the conference, the youths have been trying to voice out their opinions about issue, expressing themselves, and we had occasions where we had to break into various groups to discuss various issues that one way or the other affecting us. And it's been really good, but we've been having problems with translation, like Desra said. Lots of problems with translation, and the declaration has not yet been really, really stable. That's, we still need to sit down after the translation has been made and then try and figure out what needs to be corrected and what needs to be added. Yeah.
Well, Aisha, what are the issues that young people face in Nigeria that you feel are very critical to bring to this conference?
Well, we have the issue of education, because when you come to Nigeria, the first thing you notice is that you see children walking on the street, and it's either they're walking for their parents or they're walking for themselves to get into school. And we have the issue of gender, environment, gender, and we have issues like when they go, there are some banks that don't allow women to work because they are married. So if you're married in Nigeria, and you can't work in a bank if you're married in Nigeria. And those are the two major issues, gender and education.
Chenentu Iono, of the Indigenous Maori Collective pushing for Indigenous rights in New Zealand. What are the issues you face as a Maori?
My name's Tiano Tuiono, basically. You're from the States, can't pronounce my name properly. Well, we've been pushing for a whole lot of for Indigenous issues, and we've formed an Indigenous Youth Caucus, and we're developing our own document. People have been saying before, there's been a lot of problems with the Youth Declaration, and as part of our right to self-determination and autonomy, we thought that we should put out our own separate declaration. Still working through it right now, and I think what freaked me out about the conference, the youth summit, was that it was in a really big flash hotel, and coming from a grassroots movement, Indigenous movement where I'm from, I thought it was might have been a bit inappropriate to have it in a place like that. A lot of the issues that we face as Indigenous peoples is fighting against colonisation, the loss of our land and culture. So we, as Indigenous peoples, we feel that we are multi-discriminated against. And so a lot of the sort of work that I do where I come from is trying to fight against those forms of discrimination.
Daniela McConnell is also on the line with us from Durban, 13 years old, going into the eighth grade from Chicago. Is this your first trip outside of the United States?
No, I've been to Guatemala.
And can you talk about what this week has been like for you?
I felt that there should be more youth representation in the conference. And I felt that it wasn't clear how the youth that came from all over the world, how their voices were all going to be heard in the finalization of the document.
And how will you be heard?
Yeah.
How can you ensure that your voice will be heard?
I don't know. It wasn't clear.
The Women's International Leadership Development for Human Rights, the group that you come that you're representing, why did they choose you?
Well, my mom came with them, and there was a group of youth from that organization, and so I became part of WILD also.
Annie Vellengren is also with you with Global Kids, a first-generation American of Haitian descent entering her junior year in high school. Annie, can you tell us what has come out of the Youth Summit for you?
Well, for me, I don't believe that a lot of the things that I really wanted was really talked about, because I looked at the declaration, the draft, and I didn't see much about sexual orientation, and they talked about race. They didn't really talk about all the discrimination that really occurred, but since it's a draft, I believe that it might change a little, is going to change over time.
You made a demand, the whole youth summit at the beginning, that young people be able to speak, address the World Forum Against Racism. Did you succeed? You brought this to Mary Robinson, the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Durban, South Africa, as we talk to this group of young people who have come from around the world to be a part of this historic UN World Conference Against Racism. We're talking to Chanantu Viono, who is with the Indigenous Maori Collective, also Daniela McConnell, a 13-year-old representing the Women's International Leadership Development for Human Rights from Chicago, Aisha Hassan representing Nigeria, the Jazz 38 International Center of Hearts for Humanity, and Annie Vellengren and Desroy Bob. They're both in Durban now representing Global Kids, which is an educational group supporting urban youth as community leaders and global citizens. Desroy is a citizen of St. Vincent, Annie, 16 years old, first-generation American of Haitian descent.
Beware of the lies and false prophecy. We are many with eyes, but don't all really see. You must be merciful, my friend, to obtain the same.
So if you break the chain, don't pass the blame. We should say unto all, and I'll say it again, it's not just to win. Shake a hand, make a friend. We who are pure at heart somehow might see there's still light in the world. Come rejoice with me. It's a new day.
A new world order, a brand new day.
It's a
change of mind for the human race.
It's
a new world order, a brand new day. A change of mind for the human race. A new world order, a brand new day.
It's
a change of mind for the human race.
It's
a new world order, a brand new day. A change of mind for the human race.
It's a new day. 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 It's a new day, it's a new day. It's a new day, it's a new day.
You are listening to Democracy Now! As we continue live from Durban, South Africa. On the line with us is Deepa Fernandez, worked with us at Democracy Now! Through the summer and is now reporting as a freelance reporter from Durban. Deepa, you've been there for the last week. You also wrote a piece in this week's Village Voice about the toxic area right around the conference. You took a toxic tour of South Durban. Can you tell us a little about the environment that this conference is taking place in?
Sure, Amy. Good to be with you and all the listeners. Well, it's absolutely incredible out here in Durban, where this UN conference has just convened today, heads of state gathering to talk about racism. And basically, we're gathering to meet in an environmental toxic waste dump. So when I first got here, there was a group of residents from South Durban. South Durban, it's literally 10 minutes from the conference site. And they gathered to take us on a tour of the area where there are major industries, Shell, BP, Bayer Company from Germany, who for the last, since the apartheid era, have been polluting the area where they're basically blacks and Indians, South Asians, who were forcibly removed into the area. Forcibly removed means during the apartheid era, they moved blacks and Indians. They turned up at their houses with a truck. They said, get in the truck, bring all your things, and we're moving you. Where did they move them? They moved them into toxic waste sites where big industry had set up. South Africa has one of the largest plants in Africa in terms of Shell and BP. They bring oil, crude oil in, refine it right here in South Durban. The levels of benzene in the air are 24 times higher than anywhere else in the world. Benzene is known to cause cancer, to cause leukemia. There's all sorts of things. Asthma levels are way higher than other places in the world. So what went on was at what they called a toxic tour, where they took us through the sites. I mean, if you can imagine, if listeners can picture this, it's basically a couple of suburbs set one next to the other, with large smokestacks, industries, plants, oil refineries, smokestacks, puffing everything. There's smoke coming out in the air. There's flames everywhere you look. And people live here. These are people's backyards. There are pipes running through their backyards, which actually just 3 days ago, Shell and BP admitted another oil leak. And this oil leak, which we actually drove past, and the way that Shell and BP, where they don't actually admit it, they say, we suspect another oil leak. It's still being investigated, but the Durban press out here has reported it, which, leads residents to say if Shell and BP are saying there's a suspected leak, then there really is a leak. And this is just off of the course. This is what the residents live with day in, day out. The smell when we were in the area was incredible. I personally was physically sick for 2 days after it. It's high rates of hydrogen sulfide, which smells like rotten eggs.
Is environmental racism an issue at the World Conference?
Environmental racism is not being addressed at the official UN summit. It had to be pushed to even get on the NGO forum. The NGO forum is finishing today, actually. But environmental racism is not on the official agenda.
As
the folks at
As we wrap up, I just want to ask you to give us a little sense of these pre-conferences. We just spoke to the young people from around the world who gathered for the unofficial youth conference. That conference has taken place as well as an NGO conference?
Yeah, Amy, there was a few different gatherings. So the environmental racism one was organized independently by activists here, as was the youth Congress, they called it. It was organized by Sangoku, which is the South African NGO Congress. And they're putting these things on because basically there are issues which are not being represented. There are people who are not at the table and not being asked to speak. And you know, whether they demand to speak, whether they're just not being asked to speak, they're not there. So, yes, there was the two big major ones, which is environmental racism and the Youth Summit. The NGO, the official NGO, which is what a lot of groups around the U.S., most people out there, if you know someone, come over, they've probably come over for the official NGO conference. It's finishing up today. That was a great gathering of folks from all over the world, huge Dalit gathering from India, indigenous people from around the world, and I guess hopefully on Democracy Now! Over the next week we'll be able to hear from some of these people. But and now the official conference has started, and the bottom line is most of these people who are here, grassroots, community activists, people who are living with racism as a part of their everyday life and not a part of this official United Nations conference.
Is there going to be any coming together? Are they going to be allowed into the official conference?
There's been two, actually, actions where the Dalits of India demanded during Kofi Annan's press conference yesterday that they be represented. They have a huge delegation out here, and they're saying caste is an issue. Caste is racism. Caste is what the Dalits live with every day. They're saying this is an issue of racism and it needs to be on the agenda, as did the youth to Mary Robinson. But, you know, it's falling on deaf ears to a large extent. This conference has been planned for a long time, and what's taking up center stage is Zionism as racism and, you know, the issue of reparations, which is a very important issue to address as well.
On that issue of reparations, with the U.S. Pushing it off the agenda, is it off the agenda at the World Conference Against Racism? So since so much of the discussion in the PrepComs, the preparatory conferences, has been about reparations?
You know, Amy, right here on the ground right now, very few people actually know very little about what is on the official conference agenda. People are pushing and hoping that reparations is on there. But officially, when you look at the guide, it says declaration room to talk about racism, declaration room to talk, you know, so there's no official themes that they've given out that we have seen so far. But there's a lot of folks out here. The African descendants have come together strongly. They had a big press conference yesterday, and they're uniting across Africa, across the Caribbean, across the Americas. People of African descent are uniting strongly to demand that the issue of reparations, however that represents itself in their country, be addressed by the official conference. As yet, I don't think anybody really knows if it will come up.
Deepa Fernandez, thanks so much for joining us from Durban, South Africa, where we will continue to broadcast live all next week for the historic UN World Conference Against Racism. If you'd like to email us, you can send your mail to mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer and music maestro. Errol Maitland, our spiritual technical director. Thanks to Miranda Kennedy and Chase Pearson. And our very own Hollywood star, Roy of KPFK. A special acknowledgement to KPFA, the first Pacifica station, and all of your listeners, as well as our Pacifica affiliates around the country. All of that means all of you. We are Pacifica. Broadcasting from Downtown Community Television, or DCTV, in the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown. In the midst of a firestorm, what better place to be? In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
KPFA is the only Pacifica station where you can hear Democracy Now! As it is produced daily by Amy Goodman and her team. For information on the threat to Democracy Now! And what you can do about it, please go to the website savepacifica.net.
We sold you deregulation, said it would save you lots of dough.
Hi, this is Medea Benjamin, asking you to join me in moving from energy crisis to solutions. We need solar and wind power. We need energy.